Okay, so as I said, my talk will follow a handout. There are copies in the back of the room, so if you come in, please take a copy. Before I start, two comments. So I'm honored to honor Christian. Oh, here you are. To honor Christian. Christian is the author of an excellent book on quantum group theory that many people have read, and you know, I've often sent my students to read it. I've read parts myself when I was learning. But I have to say that it's not the ultimate book on quantum groups. So the ultimate book would be so perfectly written that it would give the reader the illusion that I could have written it myself. I mean, that the reader could have written it, you know, if I was reading it, I could have written it myself. So, you know, if I was living in the time of Newton or Leibniz, probably I wouldn't have discovered calculus. Yet calculus has been processed so much since then that by now, when you teach a calculus class, you get the feeling that you could have discovered it yourself. At least, I don't know, I somehow get this feeling, up to the Taylor remainder formula, that's where I was. I don't think such a book was written. So, you know, several people here called Christian to write a sequel about the quantum group and about quantum groups and their categorification. But I would rather call him to write the prequel. So the prequel would be the same content, but made so transparent, so based on obvious motivations that anybody could understand it, that anybody could thought it was his own. And I don't think it exists. I don't think the knowledge exists yet to write it. I think something is missing still in the foundations of quantum group theory. So, you know, given that there isn't such a thing, and given that I had huge difficulty myself understanding quantum groups, so I'm trying to find my own foundations, and of course it's very idiosyncratic, sort of very self-motive, you know, it's written in my own language. I'm working in my own language because that's what I can do. It's not clear that it will work for everyone. But I'm doing my best to motivate the whole subject on starting only from knot theory without any sort of external knowledge from algebra that is kind of has to be developed independently for 100 pages before it comes back to be applied. And so far I'm failing, but my partial results are on the screen, and I will soon start describing them. The other comment that I wanted to make is that the lectures were great. I mean, this present one excluded, but the lectures were great and will be worth listening to again. And the technology now exists to make, basically to post lectures on the web very easily. You know, you've all seen YouTube, and you know what kids can do, we can do too. So I'm not 100, it's not clear to me why aren't we doing it. So I think everybody should. I think it should be, it isn't yet, it's not yet the tradition, but it should become the tradition that, you know, with exceptions for when people should have the ability to opt out, but if they don't opt out, the lectures should be available. Why can't I re-listen to what people told us yesterday? So my own minor contribution to it is about 2 years ago I've decided to take all of my own lectures, and this lecture, as well as everything else I've given since July 2009, is on the web. So this one is being taped right now, and it will be on the web in a day or two. And the web address is, I suppose, somewhere at the top of your... Oops, sorry, the mouse is disabled. I need to re-enable it. Sorry, it is somewhere at the top of your handout, right here. Okay? Anyway, let me start. So, I guess I will be telling you about the relationship that, to the best of my incomplete understanding, about the relationship about between virtual knots, a branch of knot, a part of knot theory, and a part of quantum group theory, so the ethic of Kashdan quantization in by algebras. And I'm not happy yet with my state of knowledge, but at least I will, but it's a start. Anyway, so let's start, and I'll start from completely abstract algebra, and then I will explain how it is, in fact, related to finite type invariants, things that at least some of us in topology have seen before. So let K be an algebra and I be an augmentation ideal in it. So it's an ideal so that the quotient is the base field. But if you want, you can just think of K as being the group ring of some group, and I being the ideal of all linear combinations of group elements for which the sum of the coefficients is equal to zero. So, or alternatively, the ideal generated by differences of group elements. Okay? So you, if you have an ideal, you can always take powers of that ideal, and then you can mod out by powers of that ideal. The powers make a decreasing filtration, and then this is the so-called iadic completion, or the unipotent completion of K. And likewise, you can form the associated gradient. So you can look at I to the m, it is bigger than I to the m plus 1, so you can form the quotient, and then you can take the complete direct sum of I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1, and that's that's the graded version, the associated graded to K, ger of K relative to this ideal I. Now, in some sense, ger of K is an approximation of K. Because, well, I don't know, always the associated graded is in some sense an approximation of the original. And we might want to ask ourselves how easy it is, and also how close to the original it is. So, first of all, it automatically inherits a product from K. It's easy to show that the product of two, well, it's easy to show that it inherits a product from K. Let's call this product mu. And in particular, let mu 1 1 be the degree 1 part of this product. So it goes from I modulo I squared, so this is the degree 1 piece of ger K, let's call this thing C, and it goes from the square of C, right, because it's a product, into the degree 2 piece of the associated gradient, so into I squared modulo I cubed. Okay? Now, the quadratic approximation to this graded algebra is defined to be, when you look at the free associative algebra generated by C, so by generated by the degree 1 piece of this ger, and you mod out only by the relations that are visible in degree 1. So, in fact, these are relations of degree 2 because they live in the degree 1 square. Okay? Hence the quadratic approximation to ger k. So let's call this thing a sub I of k. And in some sense, it's an approximation to the approximation to k. Okay? And then my question is, how good are these two approximations? Okay? So, clearly this approximation, the second approximation, subjects into the first. Because you you can always, you know, if you have any thing in the free algebra generated by C, so it's just a word of degree one elements in Ger K, you can just multiply them in Ker, in K. And you can check it's a surjection. So therefore, the quadratic approximation is somehow bigger than the associated graded. Anyway, the prized object, the object I really want to find, the object that my talk is about, would be a so-called homomorphic A expansion. A homomorphic A expansion is a homomorphic map, so it maps the product to the product, and filtered, so it maps filtered degree k things to degree k things, to things of filtration degree k in A. So it will go from k to A, for which, so you see, if you have a filtered map from k to A, then its associated graded will be a map from Ger of K to Ger of A. A is graded, so Ger of A is itself. Ger of K is the first approximation. So it will be a map, so Ger of Z will be a map from Ger K to A. And the condition that I want to put is that it should invert mu. It should invert the surjection I already have from A to Ger of K. I know, this is heavy-duty algebra, it's scary, it's hard to digest at first sight. In a minute, I hope I will be able to make it a little clearer, okay? But part of the reason why I'm doing it this way is because I want to emphasize that it's completely general, okay? There's no, it's at the highest level of generality and abstraction. Anyway, yes? It may or may not exist. It's a prized object, right? If you find it, you're happy. But it may not exist. Often it doesn't. Okay. My dream is that all interesting graded objects, especially the one arising in quantum group theory, are quadratic approximations to associated graded of algebras that arise in a natural way in a topology. Okay? And furthermore, all interesting equations, graded equations that happen around quantum groups, are the equations that arise when you try to find a homomorphic expansion. So when you try to find Z. So you see, how do equations arise when you try to find Z? So typically, the way you try to find a Z, well, Z is a map from, it's a map from K to A, often K will be finitely generated. So, for example, if K is somehow related to the set of knots, then K is generated by by crossings, and then there are finitely many relations, namely the Rademeister rules. So, finding Z, if it's a homomorphism, amounts to finding its values on the generators, and these values have to satisfy equations, namely the Rademeister rules. So finding Z is a matter of solving finitely many equations for finitely many unknowns that live in the space A, which is a graded space. So my dream is that somehow all interesting graded equations that happen in quantum group theory arise from this construction. So this is a completely abstract generality, and now let's do a concrete example. So this example is from the 80s, and I think the main name behind it is Kono, but other names are around, are related to it too. So K will be the grouping of the braid group, okay? I is the augmentation ideal, as I mentioned before, so it's the ideal generated by differences. And in fact, you may as well make it be that it is generated by a single difference, because all other differences are can be written in terms of it. So it's a difference between an overcrossing and an undercrossing, and I will denote the difference between an undercrossing and an overcrossing by a sort of double point, by two strands that intersect with a double point. So people should already recognize finite type invariance right here. So if you look at I to the m plus 1, it is generated by pictures of braids that have m plus 1 double points. And then if you look at k modulo I to the m plus 1 dual, so this would be, well, this would be elements in the dual of k, so invariants of braids, which vanish on I to the m plus 1. So which vanish on braids with m plus 1 double points, meaning which are finite type of type m, again, for people who have seen finite type invariance before. So this is exactly what in finite type theory we often call Vm, the set of finite type invariants of type m. Well, I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1, the things that appear in the associated graded, well, it's easy to check that it's the dual of Vm modulo Vm minus 1. Okay? So I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1 measures how many type m invariants we have which aren't of type m minus 1. Somehow, how many more type m invariants we have beyond those that are of type m minus 1. So if you're ever planning to study finite type invariants by induction, this is the induction step. Okay? C is I modulo I squared. So it's braids with one double points modulo the relations that overcrossings are equal to undercrossings, because I mod out by having two double points. Okay? So the double point will connect two of the strands, and I'll just mark it by a purple line. So C is the set or the vector space whose basis is a vertical lines, as many vertical lines as there were strands in the braid, with one horizontal chord connecting two of these vertical lines. Alternatively, it's the set of generators, Tij, where I and J run between 1 and n, where n is the number of strands. Okay? And Tij is equal to Tji. The kernel of mu 1 1, so the thing that defines the quadratic approximation, is, well, you can check, and I will not check it on the board right now, I don't have the time to do everything I want to do, is made out of two things. So Tij commutes with Tkl if all indices are different from each other. And if you have only three indices around, then Tij commutes with Tik plus Tjk. And this is the so-called 4T relation of finite type invariants. So therefore, the quadratic approximation to K is horizontal chord diagrams. So it's the free algebra generated by C. So instead of having just one horizontal chord, you have many horizontal chords, modulo the 4T relation. And again, this is well known from the theory of finite type invariance. An expansion would be, so a homomorphic expansion would be a map from K into A, which is multiplicative and has some property with respect to the filtration, and I think I'll skip restating what this property is. But the point is that it's precisely what is the Concievich integral. Okay? So the completely abstract language I used before, in this case, reduces to stating what, once again, what is the Concievich integral. So you see, the 9 here says that I'm supposed to be at minute 9 of my talk. The 19 there says that I'm in minute 19. Okay, why is this a prized object? Why is Z such a prized object? Why do I want it so much? So first of all, it sizes K. It tells you that K is roughly of the same size as A. it's not exactly clear how to measure size, but well, that's one way of measuring size. And A is a quadratic algebra. So it's relatively easy to understand. It has generators in degree 1 and relations only in degree 2, and that's it. Okay? So it reduces topological questions to questions about quadratic algebra. For example, if you had a grade and you wanted to know if it has a square root, okay, you could use Z to map it into A, and then you'll have a question whether a specific element of A has a square root. Okay? And maybe I gave a bad example. Actually, this is not a useful example, but in principle, algebraic questions in K becomes algebraic question in A, and A being graded and quadratic, you can study it degree by degree. So in principle, it gives you a tool to answer topological questions. In particular, it gives you an invariant. So Z would be an invariant of elements of K. So one thing that you could study is whether K are equal or not. I should say that it gives meaning to questions in the algebra, in graded algebra, sorry. So questions in graded algebra, as I said before, often become whether Z exists or not, and I think that's often a much prettier way of asking, of posing these questions. And as we will see later, often A is a space of diagrams, just like here it was a space of diagrams. So often it's a space of diagrams, and these diagrams often represent universal formulas in the algebras. So somehow A often represents universal formulas in the algebra. So formulas that for any Lie algebra would represent an element in the universal enveloping algebra of this algebra. And I think I'll stop here and move on. I don't know why I have this shift issue, that all slides come out shifted. Anyway, a second example, and I go through it very, very briefly. So there is something called pure virtual braids, and there is a theorem by Peter Lie, whose picture was above, virtual braids. So what are virtual braids? Virtual braids are essentially like braids, or more or less like braids, except sort of there are times when you don't look at the braid, and then things can cross, and you can't even tell if they cross above or below. Okay, so when you look, you see crossings, and the usual Lie-domeister moves between them, but there are also times when you don't look at the braid, and then crossings don't have a sense anymore. And there are some relations, but I will not state what they are. Okay? Anyway, you can check that the quadratic approximation to virtual braids are so-called arrow diagrams, so they're like chord diagrams, except that they are directed. And an older theorem of Bartholdi, Enriquez, Ettingoff, and Reins is that there is no homomorphic expansion for virtual braids. So if you want, it's a counterexample to the triviality of the question that I'm asking. It's not that there always is a homomorphic expansion. Here is an example where there isn't. Okay? And I think I should move on to my next example. And my next example, actually my next examples, so really the whole story can be generalized from groups to higher algebraic structures, to general algebraic structure. So what's a general algebraic structure? A general algebraic structure might be made of several spaces, not a single space. Okay? So unlike a group, which is a single space, I might have objects of many different kinds. So kind K1, kind K2, kind K3, kind K4. And then, instead of having just one binary operation, like in the case of groups, I might have many operations, so there might be a unary operation psi1 going from k1 to k2, and there might be a binary operation psi2 that takes one input in k1 and one input in k2 and produces an output in k3, and so on. There might be more. Okay? So, again, for the lack of time, I will not give the general definition of a general algebraic structure, but this is roughly the picture. Many spaces, many potential many possible operations between them, and possibly some axioms relating these operations. Okay, like the axioms of a group, associativity or something. For the purpose of my talk, let me add that I must have the free structure over some set of generators. This notion must make sense. And also, let me say that I will always allow formal linear combinations, like in a group ring. So I will always allow taking formal linear combinations of objects, provided they're of the same kind. So each K is, in fact, a linear space. So K1 is a linear space, K2 is a linear space, and so on. And the products, the operations, will be linear or multilinear, well, depending on their arity, okay? So, here is an example. I don't know what is going on. My computer is ill-behaved today. So, here is an example. So, a quando, it's kind of like a group. It's, again, just a single set with a single operation, except the axioms are, well, there are some appetizer axioms and I will not state them, but the main axiom is a self-right distributivity, okay? So x up y up z is x up z up y up z. You know, you're used to seeing these axioms where the first up is plus and the second up is times. Then you just call it distributivity. Yes, then you just call it distributivity. But here it's self-distributivity. It's a distributivity of an operation with respect to itself. Okay? So the claim is, well, okay, I mean, the machine I produce is completely general. So it works here too. This is an algebraic structure. Therefore, you can look at the augmentation ideal within it. You can look at the associated graded relative to it, you can look at the quadratic approximation, and the claim, and I'm going to say nothing about it whatsoever, is that the quadratic approximation to a quando is a so-called Leibniz algebra. A Leibniz algebra, some people here are very fond of them, a Leibniz algebra is more or less a Lie algebra, except you drop the commutativity, the anti-symmetry axiom. Okay? So, I don't know, just a second example, if you wish. Here's the third example, and this becomes more and more complicated as we go. So, the fourth example is so-called parenthesized braids. So, parenthesized braids are braids turned into a category with several further operations. So, the objects of the category of parenthesized braids are parenthetizations. So abstract parenthetizations without actual elements that are being multiplied. So here's an example of a parenthetization. You multiply these first two dots first, and then you multiply it on the right with another dot, and then you multiply it on the right with yet another dot. Okay? Except there is nothing to multiply here. I just parenthesize dots. Likewise, at the top, this is a different parenthetization of four objects. So these two get multiplied first, then these two get multiplied, and then I multiply A times B with C times D. Except there is no product in the business, only the parenthetizations matter. And my convention is that I write parenthetizations, or one convention is to indicate parenthetizations by distance scales. So things that are multiplied first are close to each other, things that are multiplied later are medium distance from there, and things that are multiplied last are far away. Okay? And then, so these are the objects of the category. And then a morphism between two objects is a braid that has one parenthetization at the bottom and another parenthetization at the top. A picture is shown here, and I think a picture is worth 1,000 words, so I'll skip 1,000 words. Okay? You multiply by concatenation, but of course you can only multiply if the parenthetization at the top of this one is equal to the parenthetization of, at the bottom of that one, otherwise they don't sort of stack, they don't stick, they don't sort of, I don't know, you can put them on top of each other. This category has several further operations. So one operation, let's call it D2, but of course there are other D, similar D operations. So D2 would mean you double the second strand. So you count from the bottom, you look for the second strand, and you double it. Okay? And doubling it would just mean replacing it by two parallel strands, whose parenthetization is innermost. So again, the picture shows what it is. Okay? And likewise, there is an operation, there are, I guess, two more operations that I really care about. One is to add a strand on the left, far away, so outermost in the parenthetization. And another one is to add a strand on the right, far away, again, with outermost parenthetization. And then you can show that with these operations, this category is finitely generated, and in fact it's generated by just two generators. The associativity, which is a trivial braid but with non-trivial parenthetizations at its ends, and the braiding, the standard braiding. So by the way, the usual braid group is also finitely generated, but you typically need n minus 1 generators to generate it. And here, to generate all braid groups of all orders, I just need two generators. Okay? The associativity and the braiding. Okay? Except there are, of course, relations. So, for example, this product of A's of associativities is equal, so this is an associativity with a strand added on the right, this is an associativity with the middle strand doubled, and well, so on, is equal to this product of associativities. This is well known, it's the so-called pentagon identity, and if I ever were to find a homomorphic expansion for parenthesized braids, all I would have to do would be to decide on the value of A and the value of sigma, and these values would have to satisfy some equations. The equations would be, the pentagon and a similar equation that I didn't display called the hexagon. And, let's try to do it. It turns out that solving for sigma is essentially forced. There is essentially one reasonable value for sigma, so I will not say anything about it. The only real unknown is A, the value of A. A has to take values in the quadratic approximation to this category. It turns out that the quadratic approximation to this category is very closely related to the space AN, which I mentioned before, in relation to braids, because this is, after all, braids. Okay? So it's very much related to this Tij algebra modulo 4T relations. So we just have to find an element in A3, and that element has to satisfy some equations. It turns out that this is precisely what is called the Drinfeld associator. Okay? So, if you wish, here is an example of how the abstract framework of the beginning forces you to study an equation that is relevant in quantum group theory. So, the equations for a Drinfeld associator. Let me add as an aside that it also gives you more. So, in fact, Z Z, a homomorphic expansion, is an isomorphism between the unipotent completion, is automatically an isomorphism between the unipotent completion of K and the quadratic approximation. And so an associator is an isomorphism between this and that. There are many isomorphisms, so there are many associators, but whenever you have two isomorphic objects, the set of isomorphisms between them has two groups acting on it. So one is acting on the left and it's the automorphisms of the first object, and one is acting on the right and it's the automorphisms of the second object. Okay? And these groups are the so-called Grothendieck-Teichmuller and Gurr-Grothendieck-Teichmuller groups of the Bray group. So the so-called Grothendieck-Teichmuller groups sort of arise naturally within this picture. Next example. Are you with this team? Is this more or less okay? Understandable? Okay. The next example.
Something is very broken. I don't know.
The next example is not a trivalent graph. So, rather than talking about knots, let's talk about knotted graphs. So, a trivalent graph is, well, here's a picture, it's clear what it is. Okay? It's a trivalent graph, except it's also allowed to be knotted. It's actually a little bit more than that, because these lines are really ribbons, are really bands, narrow bands, and at the vertices they are to meet the way three bands meet, so like here. Okay, but I'll suppress this little bit of extra information. It's really not terribly important. Well, it's terribly important. We found it, nothing works. But it's not important in first class. Okay? Now, there are many operations on knotted trivalent graphs. So, for example, if we have a knotted trivalent graph with an edge, you can always drop it, and you get a smaller knotted trivalent graph. Alternatively, you can so-called unzip it. Unzip it, remember that it's really a band, so think of this band as having a zipper, like here, and you just unzip it, it becomes, that will not demonstrate, sorry, you just get two, sort of, you get two parallel bands like that, okay? So these are the unary operations on knotted trivalent graphs, and there is also a binary operation. So if you have, oh sorry, and I should have said, I mean here I've only drawn the skeleton, but it could have been knotted. I mean if this edge here was a trefoil knot, or you know, was very messed up in R3, I could still unzip it. Unzipping is a local operation. So this is sort of, you know, it's not only an operation on graphs in the plane, it's an operation on knotted trivalent graphs. Okay? Likewise, if you have two knotted trivalent graphs, and again, I didn't draw them knotted, but I meant them to be knotted, there is a binary operation which goes as follows. First of all, you choose two edges. You choose an edge on this and an edge on that. So this edge here and this edge there. Then you embed the two knotted trivalent graphs miles apart in R3, far, far, far away from each other. And then you add an edge connecting the two chosen edges. Okay? And it's not entirely trivial, but this is a well-defined operation. It's independent of how you add this edge. Okay? So it's a well-defined binary operation on knotted trivalent graphs. Likewise, you could have chosen two vertices and added a three-lane highway connecting these two vertices. So in effect, it's eliminating the two vertices and connecting and reconnecting the ends. Okay? But again, the picture shows it. And again, it's a well-defined operation. In fact, it follows from the previous operation. You can get the second operation from the previous binary operation by composing it with several unzips. But let's ignore this. Okay? So, theorem. the set of knotted trivalent graphs is, somehow my computer is not recognizing the size of the screen or something like that. Nothing works. I don't know what is going on. Okay, sorry. So the claim is that the set of non-trivialent graphs is actually finitely generated, in fact, finitely presented in some sense. Okay? So, and then it's not entirely obvious, but the claim is that there is essentially one important generator, and this important generator is the tetrahedron, and then there is a second minor generator, let me ignore it. Okay? And, but let me also tell you that this is not a free generator, so there are relations. In fact, you can take three tetrahedra and do the vertex connect sum here and here, you'll get this picture. Then you'll have this edge here, which you could pull down to the bottom, you'll get this picture. And sorry, you'll get sort of an edge down here. You unzip it and you get this picture. And this picture is a triangular prism looked at from above. Okay? But I could also get a triangular prism by just doing the vertex connect sum of two tetrahedra. So that's a 3 equals 2 relationship that is satisfied in my new algebraic structure. And then the claim is that with z being the value of the tetrahedron, with phi equals the value z of the tetrahedron, the equation written here becomes the Drinfeld pentagon, the same Drinfeld pentagon equation as before, but now written in some sense for universal enveloping algebras. So let me explain. I guess, first of all, I have to tell you what is the quadratic approximation to the algebraic structure I just stated. And this algebraic structure being a closed cousin of knot theory, if you've seen finite type invariants, its associated gradient is closely related to the associated gradient of knot theory. Okay? So this is a well-known thing, and in fact, it turns out that the associated gradient is... I'll just show a part of it. So if the graph was just two green edges, but it could be more complicated, then the associated gradient would be you put on top a second purple trivalent graph, like here, modulo some relations, modulo the IHX relation, which I believe was mentioned previously in one of the talks, and modulo, well, some further relations. And it turns out that this space of skeleta, green skeleta, with trivalent graphs on top of it, in some sense parameterizes formulas in the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra. So given any Lie algebra, this space will give you an element in the universal enveloping algebra of that Lie algebra. So if you have two green skeleton pieces, you'll get a formula for an element in the universal enveloping algebra, tensor squared. And the procedure is written as here. So you choose a basis, an orthonormal basis. So I guess I should have said the Lie algebra must be metrized, it must have a metric. So you choose an orthonormal basis for this Lie algebra, and call it XA, and then given a diagram, a so-called core diagram, you label the edges with letters in the French alphabet, so A, B, C, D, E, F. And then the formula is, well, you look at the vertices, so here you have a vertex, so around it there are three letters, A, B, C, So you write F sub ABC, where F stands for the structure constants of the Lie algebra. Then here you see CED, so you, DCE. So you write this, again, FDCE, where this stands for the structure constants of the Lie algebra. Then along each green edge, you see again letters, A, D, F. So you write XA, XD, XF. Along here you see BFE, so you write XB, XF, XE. And then you sum over all indices that appear here, and what you got is a formula for an element in the universal enveloping algebra of any algebra, of any Lie algebra. Well, Metra is Lie algebra. And then the claim is that if you take the phi of before, so if you take the value of the tetrahedron, interpret it in a similar manner as an element in the third tensor power of a universal enveloping algebra, and then you also interpret the equations that this 3 equals 2 equation that phi has to satisfy, then this equation written in the universal enveloping algebra of the algebra becomes the equation written over here, which is again the Greenfield pentagon equation. Okay? Okay, let's move on to the next example, and I obviously will have no time to get to the bottom of things. So the next example is so-called ribbon two knots in R4. So very briefly, the picture is as follows. So if you have a two-dimensional knot in R4, then you can think of it as a movie of one-dimensional things in R3. So here is a movie. So this is a ring. It's a one-dimensional thing in R3. Here is a movie of rings in R3. Okay. Now rings in R3 can trade places in ways that are more interesting than just points in the plane, which is braids. Okay. Namely, they could trade places like points in the plane, but in fact then there is no sense to the crossings. There is no overcrossing or undercrossing, because this is equivalent to that, because you can interpolate via this. So in R3, crossings have no sense, or for movies in R3. However, there is another way in which rings in R3 can trade places, and this is this way, which is not the same as that way. So there is again some crossings with sense. Okay? And I think I'll skip the alternative view. The alternative view is somehow to things to denote tubes. So tubes in R4 you can denote by ribbons in R3, and then these ribbons can somehow cross in R3, but yet they represent things that do not cross in R4, like things that pass through each other. And I'll skip the details. I'll only tell you that you have sort of an overcrossing and likewise an undercrossing, but also a senseless crossing. Okay? And then, and in fact, there are also several other things that you can do in R4 that you can't do in R3. So I guess a flying ring could just flip over. And that tends to have no parallel in R3. And it turns out to be related to the Klein bubble somehow, four-dimensionally. As a two-dimensional object in R4. But anyway, then there are Rydermeister rings. There are relations between these different types of crossings, and I guess they're briefly summarized here. But the point is that the ordinary crossings, or rather, the things represented by ordinary crossings, which are in fact extraordinary crossings, okay? So the ordinary crossings satisfy the ordinary Rydermeister rules. The virtual crossings, which are in fact the ordinary crossings, satisfies also the Reitemeister moves. So again, it's but now they're called the virtual Reitemeister moves. And then there is a weird relationship between the two types of crossings called overcrossings commute, which says that if you have two overcrossings and the virtual crossings, you can pass to the other side. You can pass the overcrossings to the other side of the virtual crossings. However, the symmetry between over and under is broken because you cannot do the same for undercrossings. Okay? So if this sort of third strand here, the one that's represented by an arc as opposed to by a straight line, had it been going under, then you could not slide it under the virtual crossing. And, you know, a picture summary of this is here, but I think I'll skip it. And I'll also skip all the other relationships that are, all the other relations that are around, and I will also skip the other operations that are around, but the other operations are similar to the unzip operations in three dimensions. So there is, in fact, two variants of unzip operations when you're talking about two-dimensional objects in R4. Anyway, so now that we have these gadgets, we can form an algebraic structure. And the algebraic structure will be, well, the W generator, so the types of crossings, which can be multiplied, sort of, so it's called a PA, a planar algebra, whatever that means, but they can be multiplied in any way you wish. The way you assemble a knot from crossings, you could assemble a trivalent W tangle from these weird crossings. Okay. Then there are relations, and then there are unary operations. Okay. And once you have an algebraic problem, an algebraic structure, you can ask yourself if it has a homomorphic expansion. So a homomorphic expansion turns out to be, well, you only need to find its value on the two most interesting generators, and these are the crossing and the trivalent vertex. I should have mentioned that there is also a trivalent vertex for surfaces in R, for tubes in R4. Okay? There is a way to for three vertices to meet. Sorry, for three tubes to meet in R4. So you only have to find the value of the crossing and the value of the vertex. These values have to satisfy certain relations. The most obvious of those is a certain Reitemeister 4 moves, which says that you can slide the crossing sort of under a vertex so that it becomes two crossings. Okay? And then there are some other relations which I will not describe. And the statement, which again I will not have time to describe in full, is that finding a homomorphic expansion for this structure, meaning finding the values for the crossing and the vertex, is equivalent to solving the Alexeyev-Torossian version of the Kashiwara-Wern conjecture. So it's equivalent to finding an element F in a certain group which is generated out of a free algebra. So it's essentially a certain group whose elements are diagrams, pictures of a similar nature to the pictures shown before, except directed, except the edges have arrows on them. And these elements satisfy certain equations, again, those same equations written by Kashiwara and Wern more than 30 years ago, I believe. Okay. And again, I don't have time for details, but the main example, or the thing which whose homomorphic expansion problem should most closely correspond to quantum groups is virtual knots. So virtual knots are much like the two-dimensional knots in R4 that I mentioned before, so much like these flying rings in R3. So there are two types of crossings, the virtual crossing and the real crossing. There are also vertices, and you mod out by the same relation as before, except you reinsert the same symmetry between overcrossings and undercrossings. So you do not mod out by overcrossings commute. So virtual knots are a bigger space than W knots, than the knots I talked about, and the two-dimensional knots in R4, because they are generated by the same things, but I mod out by one relation less. So topologically, virtual knots turn out to correspond to knots that, instead of being drawn on a sphere, like ordinary knots you draw maybe on a blackboard, but also maybe on a sphere. So virtual knots you draw on a general surface, as opposed to on a sphere, and then you mod out by some further equivalence relation called stabilization. But whatever it is, the diagrammatic picture for virtual knots is crossings, but two types of crossings, modulo the same relations that I mentioned before, except you drop the overcrossings commute relation, and then there are again some unary unzip operations. Okay? And the quadratic approximation to the associated graded was conjectured and more or less understood by Polyak and Ohtsuki to be, again, a certain space of arrow diagrams. So pictures like before, except now the edges have directions on them. And well, in the vertices, you either have two in, one out, or one in, two out. No sources and no sinks. Okay? So this is the sort of combinatorial space, the space that arises as the associated graded of virtual knots. And then there are relations. And again, I don't have time to state precisely what the relations are, but again, they look like the IHX relations, so they look more or less like Jacobi relations. And indeed, you can show that that space, so I'll call it AV for A virtual knots, you can show that it pairs with Libye algebras. So given any Libye algebra, a diagram like this represents a formula for an element in the universal enveloping algebra of the double of that Libye algebra, as it turns out. Okay? So somehow you get Libye algebras automatically out of this picture. And then, okay. And then there is a forbidden theorem, I'll explain the word forbidden in a minute, which says that this picture actually has a homomorphic expansion. And this forbidden theorem, in fact, captures a big chunk of the Ettinghoff-Kashdan theory of quantization of Libye algebra. So in fact, that this theory of quantization of Libye algebra amounts to finding several elements in the universal enveloping algebra of a Libye algebra which satisfy some relations. And it turns out that these elements correspond to the crossings and the vertices that occur in virtual trivalent tangles, and the relations are the relations. Okay? So the reason I call it a forbidden theorem is, well, first of all, it's only personally forbidden. It's forbidden for me. I feel that it is, I'm not allowed to use it. I mean, I'm allowed to tell you about it, but I'm not allowed to really use it. And the reasons are, first of all, minor statement details might still be off. There are various orientations issues that I haven't figured out yet. Second, there isn't a fully written proof anywhere. Third, I don't understand the proof. The proof very much depends on Etikov and Kashdan's work, and I can understand how the non-theoretic statement is related to the algebraic statement, but I could not understand the algebraic proof. And part of the reason I cannot understand the algebraic proof is because I suspect that there should be a not theoretic counterpart for this algebraic proof. The proof itself should be stated in not theoretic terms. So every time I try to read their proof, I instead end up trying to find my own. And it always gets closer, but I'm not quite there. But as a result, I was never able to actually finish reading their proof of that statement. Okay? Maybe I should add that in the W case, so in the case of flying rings in R3, so this is the Alexeyev-Torossian case, or maybe the Alexeyev-Enriquez-Torossian case, there is a non-theoretic version of the proof. So it's not an idle hope. Okay? Anyway, why should anyone care? And I'm running out of time. So to me, it would be a gateway into the forbidden territory of quantum groups. For me, the whole territory of quantum groups is forbidden because I don't really understand them. And that's my kind of hope of understanding them in simple-minded, non-theoretic language. Okay? And I think it's abstractly more pleasing. Somehow, well, you know what, maybe I will not give the details, but you know, I really skip the details. I'll just say that sort of this theory ends up having potentially more non-theoretic value than the standard sort of finite-type theory of knots. And I mean, I could say more about it, but not right now. Here is a very, very brief, quick outline of the Alexeyev-Enriquez-Torossian proof in the W case. And, you know, if I had hours more, I would tell you how the Alexander polynomial is a very easy consequence sort of of this picture. And I would also tell you about some computational evidence that all of this does work, but again, I don't have time for this, so I'll just end with telling you that, again, much is missing, so your help is needed, and I'll finally end with my usual propaganda. So, I'll stop. So you see, I mean, having a timer here, I could not ignore that I'm late. Okay.
Thank you very much. Question?
I mean, you still don't understand anything, okay? So let's make things more complicated. How would categorification fit into all this?
Yeah, that's the most...
Because here the algebra is still very simple. I mean, these iadic completions and these sections for...
No, so categorification obviously doesn't fit in this picture. Categorification is a global, or it happens at the level of Q, not at the level of the logarithm of a power series expansion in which Q is written as e to the x. Okay? So it does not fit with categorification. Nevertheless, my own personal history was that I was interested in finite-type invariants, not for virtual knots, I mean for ordinary knots, for a long time, I'm sure you know that. Then for a while I got interested in categorification, and with categorification, the obvious next question, so that was at the time there was only a categorification of the Jones polynomial, so only Hovanov, the original basic Hovanov homology existed. And the obvious question to ask when was clear, right? When only Hovanov homology existed, the obvious question to ask was, well, how do you categorify the other Reshetic interior invariants? So obviously it was somewhere on my mind, and it was completely impossible for me to even start studying this question, because I never understood Reshetic interior seriously, deeply. For me, Reshetic interior, for me, quantum groups were always a mystery. You know, I never fully understood them. Sorry, Christian, I mean, that's the truth. You know, the graduate level book was written, but I needed the high school level book. And my feeling was that the reason I don't understand quantum groups is because the foundations are written incorrectly. And again, this is not a statement about any book or another. It's a statement about our state of our understanding. I think that when talking about Reshetic interior invariants, somehow we don't understand the domain space properly. The domain space we think is knots, but I think should be virtual knots or virtual trivalent tangles with possibly some issues that have to do with orientations and normalizations. We don't really understand the domain space of that theory of invariance properly. Okay? The fact that Reshetic interior invariants extend or almost extend to virtual knots, I mean extend with some minor minor conventions issue. But the fact that they almost extend to virtual knots really say that they should be thought of as invariants of virtual knots and not of ordinary knots. So I decided to spend some time searching for the domain space of knot theory, or of quantum knot theory. And I don't think the domain space is ordinary classical U knots, but rather it is some variant of the V knot theory that I'm talking about here. So, you know, maybe, and now I'm possibly hallucinating, but maybe one day we will understand categorification better when we understand what the things are better. And the things are not knots, but virtual knots. And again, what virtual knots exactly, I'm not yet settled. Okay? So that was my motivation.
At the very beginning, you said that what you are coming down to a quadratic algebra. There are some quadratic algebras which are better than others, and those which satisfy Cauchy's duality. Is it going to play a role in your analysis?
Proof that I mentioned before by Peter Lee, where was it? If you wanted to summarize the case of pure virtual braids with one word, it would be Kozul duality. So somehow Peter shows how to reduce the question that I mentioned here to a question about Kozulness of a certain algebra. So far this is the only place where Kozulness interacts with this story. This is not a statement about the future, it's a statement about the present.